Okay, thank you, and thank you to the organizers for putting this together and letting me talk. I think this is a boring title, having looked at everybody else's titles, but this is what you get when someone asks for a title like weeks before you've decided what you're actually going to talk about. So I chose the most generic thing I could because pretty much all of my research fits into that topic somehow. So. Okay, so I'll just give you a very, very short version of my story as a PUI faculty member. I sort of have two perspectives on this. My first tenure-track faculty job was at Henderson State University, which is in southwest Arkansas, somewhere sort of down here. And I spent 3 years there, and then I moved to what I think is a better faculty position at Illinois State University, and I've been there for 2 years now. And I really like it. So that's the short version of me. I have sort of the two perspectives, with Henderson State being a small university with four faculty, and now Illinois State, and I will tell you a little bit about that. We're bigger. We have about 130 physics majors total on average, and we graduate about 18 students per year. We have 11 faculty and 4 degree sequences, and if you're wondering, we're sort of halfway between Chicago and St. Louis. This is normal Illinois right there, which is where I am in the middle of what we call the Great Corn Desert. So, okay, so now on to my talk. I like the Big Bang Theory, so this is Sheldon with his game that he has invented, Research Lab. If you can't quite read it, it says, the physics is theoretical, but the fun is real. So it seems appropriate for a gathering of theorists. So I'll start by giving a short historical perspective of atomic collisions, because this is a field that has been around over 100 years now. You can maybe trace it back to Rutherford, if not even earlier than that. Rutherford got the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1908, actually not for the thing that we probably are now thinking of with atomic collisions, but for investigating the disintegration of elements and the chemistry of radioactive substances. He's perhaps better known for his gold foil experiment, where he basically shot alpha particles at gold foil and came up with the idea that there must be a nucleus in the atom. And so that was in the early 1900s. So we've been studying atomic collisions for a long time. It's a very mature field, but there's still a lot that can be learned and a lot that we don't understand. I like to tell my students who are interested in research, and even the ones who aren't, and I talk about my research, we tend to think about things classically, even though all of the work that I do is fully quantum mechanical. It's just easier for us to picture little particles. So it's a lot like playing pool. So you have this thing called a projectile, and you take your projectile and you shoot it at something that is an atom or perhaps a molecule. In my case, it's usually helium atoms. And then basically your atom breaks apart just like it does when you play pool, and so you have ionization events or you have excitation or various other processes that can occur. But as we know, things at the atomic level are governed by quantum mechanics. And so that leads to the Schrodinger equation. And so the idea behind this for atomic collisions is that we want to understand about atomic structure and also about few particle interactions on the atomic level. And as you all know, if we can figure out what our wave function psi is, then essentially we know everything. The problem is that we don't know psi, and oftentimes we can't even find it, no matter how hard we look. So this makes things tricky, and it leads us to approximations in order to be able to do the calculations that we need. So that was the short historical perspective. We'll skip ahead to the stuff that I'm working on and some of what is the underlying problem of atomic collisions. So basically, we know what the force is between particles in an atomic collision. It's just the Coulomb force. So any student in introductory physics can tell you about the Coulomb force. It's 1 over r squared force between your two charged particles, and we all know that if you just have two of them, that's no problem. That's like the hydrogen atom. We can solve that analytical pencil and paper, no problem. But if you now add in a third particle, we begin to have problems. And up until about, I would say, 10 or 15 years ago, we weren't really very good at the three-body problem, but numerical solutions have advanced quite a bit in those last 10 to 15 years. And there are actually now several techniques that can provide us with an exact numerical solution for three-body scattering. I have to clarify that a little bit because it's only for a certain problem, which is electrons colliding with hydrogen. So if you do an electron colliding with hydrogen, then we can get an exact numerical solution. If you start talking about protons or alpha particles or other heavier particles colliding with hydrogen, we don't have a numerical solution. And also, if you have three of them in the continuum, we're not so good at that either. So, Nate.
Can I ask this question? Because I hear this phrase, exact numerical solution, and I hear it from a lot of people, not just from you. And to me, that's an oxymoron.
Yeah, I would say that essentially they're putting the... I think in my case, they're basically diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. They're doing it in a non-time dependent way, so it's time independent, and they're just basically turning the crank until they get convergence.
So does exact in the sense mean that, like, guaranteed convergence?
I think so, yes. Okay. Yeah, that's what I would say, at least in my field.
So. Quantum Monte Carlo would be a similar sort of approach, right? Or break down your Hamiltonian, you simulate. The longer you simulate it, the more complex.
So the three-body problem that has a numerical solution would be like if you took these two and that's hydrogen. So you have a proton and an electron, there's your hydrogen, and now this guy is an electron that is your projectile. So it's coming in and scattering off of hydrogen.
Right.
Yeah.
So can I ask one other question?
Sure.
So you said if we had three states in the continuum, it would be a problem. And a proton would be a problem just because the proton-proton interaction is more complicated?
A proton as a projectile is a problem, I guess, numerically in this case.
Because it's massive.
Because it's massive, and so it's much harder to get convergence of your numerics.
So you want two white objects.
Yes.
Which is bound to the heavier object.
Yes, yeah. And so I think eventually we'll get to a point where we probably have a generic numerical solution for projectile colliding with hydrogen, but right now the numerics just aren't there to be able to do it. So. Okay, so things are somewhat complicated with three particles. What I like to study is even more complicated, the four-body problem. There is no numerical or analytical solution for this particular problem, which leaves us with a lot that we have left to learn, but it's also difficult numerically, and if you were to try analytically as well, to solve this. So, and if you're wondering where the sequence goes to five bodies, well, that's not me, so ask Nate. Maybe he could tell you something about that. Yeah. Okay, so problems that I'm interested in, primarily the ionization process. I'm really interested in the basic fundamental physics of how the particles interact, but there are lots of applications of ionization processes. I won't run down the list, but you can pretty much pick any field and you can make a tie with ionization. In particular for this talk, I will attempt to talk about two different topics, although I think I will only get through the first one, which is the frozen core approximation. And the second one, if we have time, will be out-of-plane collisions. So we'll start with the frozen core approximation. So let me start by showing you a cartoon picture of a four-body ionization collision. So here we have helium, so we have a nucleus and two electrons, and then a projectile, which I have not specified whether it's an electron or a proton or some other heavy ion. But you send your projectile in, it collides, you ionize one electron, so you end up with a projectile and an electron in the continuum, and then you're left with what is essentially helium plus behind as your target ion now in the final state. Yes, it is a very classical picture, but makes it easy to sort of imagine and visualize. So what is the frozen core approximation, or what I will sometimes call the three-body model? Well, you're going to take your helium atom, which is a nucleus and two electrons, and what the frozen core approximation does is to basically lump one of those electrons in with the nucleus, and you call it a core. So you're not really combining it with the nucleus, you're just calling this thing the core. And then this electron is the one that will get ionized, and it's called the active electron. So essentially, you ignore the electron that is not ionized and sent into the continuum, and that is the frozen core approximation. Yes. Yeah, so it reduces your four-body problem to a three-body problem. If you like the animations, it now looks like this, a core with a single active electron. Your projectile comes in and collides, you ionize that active electron, and what's left behind now has no structure, it's just considered a core with a charge of plus one.
So, for your collision processes, what sort of impact parameter does the proton have?
Well, so I actually do a quantum mechanical calculation, so there are no impact parameters in that sense. So if you're doing some inner, let's see. So if it's electrons, I'm usually in the order of 100 eV for electron energy. If it's proton energy, it's somewhere 50 to 100 keV for protons. Atomic unit velocities would be one or two or something. Does that help?
Yeah, that's fine.
OK. Yeah. OK, so the frozen core approximation has been used successfully for decades for studying ionization processes. And as you can imagine, it simplifies the calculation because you've gone from four particles with 3 degrees of freedom each down to three particles. So your calculation gets simpler. But the problem, so to speak, is that helium really has two electrons. And so the question is, what effect does that second inactive electron have? And in particular, what is the effect on the cross-section, which is the thing that I calculate? So most of the calculations that I do are within perturbation theory. And we look at what are called fully differential cross-sections. And now I'm going to put a statement up there that you're all going to go, that can't be possible. What does fully differential cross-section mean? It means that you know the position and momentum of all the particles before and after the collision, and you're thinking, I violated the uncertainty principle. Okay, well, when experimentalists measure this, they certainly don't measure it to within the accuracy where you would have to worry about the uncertainty principle. But within their error bars, they know basically where all of their particles hit the detectors, what their momentum is. And so the problem is, in that sense, completely specified in terms of the things that we know. So, okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of math. This will be, I think, just about all the math that shows up in the next two slides, and then we'll get to some results. So the fully differential cross-section is proportional to this thing called the transition matrix squared. And your transition matrix is a matrix element between your initial state and your final state with some perturbation in the middle within a first order perturbation theory. And now for the four-body model, what we want to do is compare a four-body with a three-body model and see what's missing, what's different. And so you look at your initial state here. It's written as a product of a projectile wave function and a target helium wave function. So your target helium wave function is basically for your target atom. Then you have a projectile wave function that is an interaction somehow between this projectile and the target. I'm not really going to go into the details of how we treat that interaction, but it is there. In the final state, where you now have a scattered projectile, you have a scattered projectile wave function where it interacts with your ion. You also have an ionized or ejected electron wave function where that interaction is included with the ion as well. And then you have a bound wave function for your helium plus. And then there's the perturbation, which is a certain four-body perturbation. I'll show it later. I'm not going to talk about it right now. The important thing is that it's different than what you get in the frozen core approximation. Okay, everybody good so far? Okay, so if we go to the frozen core or three-body model, you'll notice things are a little bit different. In the initial state, we still have a projectile wave function and a target wave function, but now this target wave function just has a single active electron instead of two electrons. In the final state, we still have a scattered projectile wave function, an ionized or ejected electron wave function, but we've lost a term here which would represent the electron in the helium ion. That's no longer there. We've also changed our perturbation from a four-body to a three-body perturbation. So there are certainly differences. This slide I will sort of go through quickly because I just highlighted it on the previous slide, but the differences between the two models, the initial state helium atom wave function, if you're looking at the three body here, you just have the one electron wave function. In the four body, you have a two electron wave function, and with that two electron wave function, these two electrons can essentially talk to each other, which is what we call correlation. I know in condensed matter there's something called correlation that you guys deal with. It's different than what we call correlation in atomic collisions. Here are the perturbation potentials. The perturbation essentially comes from the interaction of your projectile with your target, and it's just the Coulomb potential between the projectile and all the constituents of your target. And so in the three body, you'll have two terms. You'll have a projectile electron term, and I guess this is now specific to an, this is specific to an electron projectile. So you have this interaction, which is this term, and then you have the electron with the core, which is this term. If you look at the four-body perturbation, you have extra terms, one extra term now because you have the projectile with each of the electrons, so there's two of these terms, and then the projectile with the nucleus, which is this term. Okay, so two differences so far. There are two more. The third difference is the final state helium plus wave function. In the three-body or frozen core model, you don't have anything. It's just a core, so there is no helium plus wave function. But in the four-body, you actually have a 1s hydrogen-like helium plus wave function. And the fourth difference, in the final state, your free electrons, or your projectile, if it's not an electron, but it moves in a different potential. So you can see that in the, in the three-body case, for instance, this guy moves in the potential of a single particle, but down here it's moving in a potential that's made up of two terms, one from the nucleus and one from the electron. So the final state potentials for your free particles are different.
You're the inactive electron, right,
Chair? Yep.
It's always in the 1s state. Or not, or will
yes,
it?
Okay, so that's the second half of my talk, is if it's not in the 1s state. So this is just straight ionization. So yes, in order to use the frozen core approximation, it has to stay in the 1s state. So it's frozen, it starts off in a 1s state, and it stays in a 1s state. Okay, so let me explain a little bit about fully differential cross-sections. I tell my students you can think of them like a probability. If you were to look at a polar plot of this, what you have happen is you have a projectile come in, collision occurs at the origin, and your projectile scatters off here. These curves are basically the probability of finding the ionized electron. So the bigger lobe that you have out here means that you're more likely to find the electron at this particular location than you are, say, right here. Right, so these are just two different theories and some experimental results. These are polar plots. They're more intuitive, sort of as a physical picture of things, but it's not how we tend to look at things. So typically what we do is we will take this polar plot, we will essentially cut it right down here along the direction of the incoming projectile, sort of stretch it out. You end up with a thing that looks like this, or in the actual plots I'm going to show you, you have the cross section here and the ionized electron angle from 0 to 360 here. And so this polar plot turns into this. And so where you see a large peak is about, 60 degrees here. So that would have corresponded to where we had this big bump out here. So it's a little harder to sort of imagine things, but quantitatively it's easier.
Why is zero straight back, not 180?
Zero is measured from this direction, from the forward projectile. So this is zero, and then we go here, zero, all the way around to 180. Oh, do I have it backwards? Yes, I do. Yeah, flip that around. Sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, the two sides are mirror image.
I've given this talk to students like 5 times and no one ever noticed. So. Yeah.
So we're looking at the ionized electron, so that's the one that got kicked out of the helium.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
And some disconnect, just for the
some disconnect is taking place in my brain. Why is this not 0 to 180? I mean, why is this not...
symmetric?
Yeah.
About 180.
About 180.
So what I can tell you is sort of the physical picture of what's happening is this is called the binary peak, and this corresponds to sort of a classical binary collision where the projectile comes in, hits the electron that it's going to ionize directly, and pushes it forward. In order to get this peak coming out in the backwards direction, you basically have a higher order process. So your projectile comes in, it hits the electron, but then the electron gets swung around by the nucleus. It's influenced by the nucleus, and it comes out backwards.
But am I brain damaged? What's 0 to 180? Why isn't it the same? So
this is the incoming projectile is 0. This is 180 is opposite the incoming projectile. It's just, I mean, think about playing pool, right? So if you play pool, you're most likely to get something other than the cue ball to come out in the forward direction. It's very unlikely that it has a second collision and comes out backwards.
I'm thinking about the problem as being symmetric about some axis.
It is symmetric about...
And if I flip that plot you showed upside down, it's going to be the same thing. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah. So I
think you're thinking there is some symmetry in the process in terms of everything that I've described has basically happened on the plane of, like, a table. Okay, just like playing pool. But if you were to look above the plane or below the plane, that is symmetric. Maybe that's...
Isn't that just 180 degrees? No, I guess not.
No, okay. We're going around
all
this
right.
way. So you're more likely to have the electron come out forward than you are to have it come out backwards.
Why is it symmetric left and right of the straightforward line?
Because your projectile scatters to the left. And so if you think momentum conservation, if your projectile scatters to the left, then your other electron should go to the right.
Assuming it scatters to the left.
Yes. Maybe. By what angle does the projectile scatter? I didn't put it on this picture. It's fixed. It's fixed. So this one is fixed, and I didn't write it on there. Yeah.
Oh.
Maybe that answers the question.
That answers the question. Thank you.
Sorry. Something that I just assume in my brain that I forget other people don't know. Yes, the fully differential. That's one of the parameters is that this, the scattering angle of the scattered projectile is fixed. And then you basically scan for the electron that's kicked out.
Thank you.
Yes. Sorry, that wasn't clear. Okay, so now that you have figured out what one graph looks like, I'm going to completely overwhelm you with 9 graphs. I don't really want to focus on the details of all of these, other than to tell you that the black curve is the four-body model, and the blue dashed curve is the frozen core approximation. And this is fully differential cross-section on the vertical and ionized electron angle on the horizontal. Each of the different panels is for different what we call kinematics. So different projectile energies, different scattering angles, different energy of the outcoming electron, the ionized electron, just lots of different cases. The important thing that I want to point out is that if you compare the black curve to the blue curve, they're different, right? How they're different is in the details and the fact that there's experimental results as the crosses and whether or not we agree with the experiment, that's a whole nother story. But for this talk, just that the four-body model and the frozen core approximation are different, right? So clearly it makes some effect if you do this frozen core approximation.
Can you remind me what Q is?
Q is what we call the momentum transfer.
Okay.
So it's how much momentum is transferred from the projectile to the target or... Yeah. Okay, so this is for an electron projectile. And the frozen core and the four-body model give you different results. If you look at a proton projectile, the results are still different. They're not as different. So the curves are a little closer together, but there are some discrepancies like here and so forth. And so what I was wondering is, okay, well, why are they different, right? I had these four differences between the models that I identified, right? Is it the target wave function? Is it the final state potential? Which of those things, or maybe all of those things, what's causing the differences? So what part of the frozen core approximation causes the differences in the cross-section? I will walk you through one of these, and then I will skip ahead to the answer. So one of the possibilities is that it's the initial state helium wave function, because in the frozen core approximation, you just have this one active electron. But in the four-body model, you have two electrons. And so what we did was we used our four-body model, and we basically replaced this two-electron wave function that had correlation in it and was fancy and complicated. We replaced it with basically a product of two independent one-electron wave functions. And we thought, okay, well, if these two now no longer talk to each other, but they're completely independent, and the inactive one doesn't change its state, that will tell us what effect this particular difference has on the cross-section. Okay, so here is the electron projectile graph that I showed you before. The black curve and the blue curve are the same. What I've added is the red dotted curve, which is what happens when you take the four-body model and replace that two-electron wave function with a product of one-electron wave functions. And it basically comes out sitting right on top of the black curve, which is the four-body curve. And so that tells me that this particular difference in the theories doesn't have any effect on the cross-section, because I changed something in the four-body model, and the results still look the same as the four-body model. So I now know that the initial state helium wave function is not the source of the discrepancies. We repeat this sort of testing procedure for all of the other differences that we identified. Skip ahead. And the answer is that the difference that matters is the treatment of the ionized electron, so the potential that the ionized electron sees, strangely enough, combined with the perturbation. So if you change both of those things together, then we get some interesting results. That happens to be true for both electrons and heavy ion projectiles. And now I'm going to switch colors on you a little bit. Sorry for that. The black curve is still the four-body. The blue curve is still the frozen core. But when I change the perturbation and I change the potential that the ionized electron sees, I get what is a gray dash dotted curve. It's like right here and right here. It's basically sitting on top of the three-body model in most cases. So I changed two things in the four-body model, and now suddenly I get the three-body model. So those things must be the cause of the differences. And more analysis of the physics we haven't quite figured out. We know this is the case. We don't understand why you have to combine two things to get this to happen. That's something we're still curious about.
So if you change one of them, does it go in between, or does it still stick at the original?
It depends on which one you change. If you change just the perturbation, it doesn't do anything. It looks just like the four-body model. If you change just the potential that the ionized electron sees, it goes sort of in between. But then when you change them both, it goes all the way to the three-body model. So we don't quite understand that yet. But that seems to be the way it is. We were also actually very surprised that this seems to be a universal feature for electrons and heavy ion projectiles. I was not expecting that, but okay, so conclusions for the frozen core approximation. The differences between the three-body and four-body model are caused primarily by the treatment of the ionized electron, but there's some weird additive effect that happens when you also change the perturbation. And we've done two papers, one for the electron and one for the heavy ions on this. Okay.
Does heavy ion include protons?
Yes, it does. Yeah, heavy ions for atomic collisions are basically anything other than an electron or a positron. Those are considered light. Anything else is heavy. And other heavy things would be protons, alpha particles, carbon nuclei. So they're always bare nuclei.
Not carbon plus?
Nope. Typically, we work with bare nuclei.
Is that because that's what you make in a Van de Graaff?
That's a good question. Why experimentally they do that? I mean, there are people who study, for instance, carbon plus. But then you have a structure to your projectile.
Your projectile has
a structure, and now your atom has a structure, and now we've got more than four particles.
And that's more than five.
Yeah, definitely more than five.
Five electrons.
Yeah. So, that's a whole different class of problems. Okay. Other questions?
Microphone's right in front of you. Do you worry about the state of the non-ionized electron? What state it's in?
Right, so for straight ionization with the frozen core approximation, the non-ionized electron is always in the ground state. And I can tell you, because the next thing I'm going to talk about is what happens when it's not in the ground state, but the probability of being in the ground state is much higher than the probability of being in an excited state. So, and experimentally, they can actually resolve these based on energy resolution. So they know not only is it in the ground state, but if it happens to be in an excited state, they can usually tell you which excited state it's in. So.
These calculations, they're not in the time domain?
They're time independent, that's right.
Okay, so, what sort of methods do you use to, like computational methods? Is there like a...
So, without going back through all my slides and animations, the T matrix, the transition matrix that I put up with the initial state, final state, and perturbation, when you evaluate that, you have two choices. You can evaluate in position space or momentum space. We typically do position space, and so that results in a nine-dimensional integral. You get three dimensions, 3 degrees of freedom for each of the particles, and now you're saying I have four particles, so I should get 12. Can I erase a little something? So we basically measure from the nucleus. So if you have a nucleus here and you have two electrons, so here would be one coordinate with three spatial coordinates, another one with three, and a third one with three. And so relative coordinates, you can get down to a set of three position vectors, which gives you nine overall degrees of freedom. And so we're doing a nine-dimensional integral, which is computationally somewhat difficult. Usually when you get to nine dimensions, you would want to go to a Monte Carlo type approach. We actually do this with Gauss-Legendre quadrature. The reason is that there's some symmetry to the problem in the sense that this projectile doesn't scatter very much. And because of that, you can really, you know, limit your integration space to sort of a narrow can along the projectile direction, which eliminates the need to sort of integrate out here or way down here. And so Monte Carlo, it's harder to restrict yourself, but with Gauss-Legendre, we can limit our space that we're integrating over. So.
Is this a grid space? Are you discretizing the space? Okay.
Yes.
I wasn't sure if you're using like a basis set or.
No, we're discretizing space.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Good. Okay. The second part of the talk. Out of plane collisions. Give you a little bit of a classical picture and a little bit of a history of this. So if we go back to our model of plane pool. Typically, the plane of the table is called the scattering plane. It's defined by the initial and final momentum vectors of the projectile. So you have an incoming projectile and a scattered projectile. You take those two vectors, that defines your scattering plane. And usually what happens is that your ionized electron stays in the scattering plane. And if you just think classically about momentum conservation, if you have this projectile that comes in and it hits an electron, and then the projectile scatters, well, the momentum vectors of the projectile define your scattering plane. Therefore, your other particle must stay in that plane, right? If you didn't start out with any momentum out of the plane, then you can't possibly get momentum out of the plane after the collision. And so most of the time, the electron stays in the scattering plane. But this is not a classical problem, and we have more than two particles involved. There's a nucleus and another electron, so you can have momentum sharing among those other particles, which means that you can actually get the ionized electron to come outside of the scattering plane, so either above or below what I would call the pool table. Off the pool table, I would like to see somebody scatter something below the pool table. Tunneling or something, right? So the problem is that theory currently can't explain the experimental results when this happens. So when you get outside of the scattering plane, theory really starts to break down. This was something that was made very evident in a Nature paper back in 2003. And so this is, these are fully differential cross sections for carbon 6 plus colliding with helium, and it's straight ionization, so you're inactive electron is in the ground state. The top picture here is the experimental results. And so just like the two-dimensional polar plots that I showed, if you see a big lobe, that's where the electron is most likely to come out. The collision occurs right here in the middle. If I remember the geometry correctly, I think we have a... Yeah, we have a projectile coming from the bottom. It's heavy particle ionization, so it doesn't scatter very much, and now you're looking at where you find the ionized electron. So this is experiment in the top, and the bottom is the best theoretical calculation, at least at the time, 2003, 12 years ago. And the biggest thing that you can notice is if you look very near the collision region, at the origin here, there's a difference, right? The experiment shows this sort of smeared out structure around the origin, but theory has it very pinched off with two distinct lobes, right? So there's been a lot of work in the last 12 years about why is there no structure in the theory, and there have been lots of people who have been trying to tackle this problem. We still actually, of all the theories that have been proposed and calculations that have been done, we still can't get something that looks like the experiment. So most of the theories are still showing this pinched off two-lobe structure. But for me, there's too much competition with this particular problem because this paper came out in Nature and it's a big conundrum in the field. Everybody is working on it. So I'm not particularly interested in this problem, but I'm interested in a related problem, which is experimentally much harder to do. My experimental colleagues constantly tell me that when I beg them for experimental results. But so I'm going to look at what is called the excitation ionization process. This one is a true four-body process. There's nothing you can do to model it as a three-body process. And this is what happens when that inactive electron is left in an excited state. And one of the reasons I think it might be interesting is that you can have possible orientation effects of your helium plus ion. So for instance, if that inactive electron is left in a P state of some sort, right, you'll have some sort of lobe structure with your P state, and you can have that oriented after the collision, either vertical or perhaps horizontal. And so there might be something interesting there to look at. Okay, so this is a cartoon of what happens in excitation ionization. I worked with some collaborators on this. They were asked to produce a video about their results, and they asked me for an animation. So here's the animation. Electron comes in, collides with helium. They jostle around a bit. Your electron scatters off. You ionize one, and this guy's left in an excited state. That's why he's happy. And eventually, he will drop back down to the ground state and emit a photon if it's a radiative decay process. And so now he's back in the ground state. And so,
no longer happy.
He's back to bored. Uh-oh. Why am I going automatically? Where's that timing? Sorry. Technical difficulties. I don't use timings. I do not want to use timings. Okay, well, we can watch the animation again. Experimentally, what they can do is they'll measure, just like they were doing before, the scattered projectile, the ionized electron, and they can also measure the photon that comes out to know if it's in a P state. If there's no photon that comes out, or if they're not able to measure all of those in coincidence, they can still know, based on energy loss of the projectile, what state your helium plus is left in. Okay, so that is excitation ionization.
So you could also tell by the emitted photon that you have to catch it in any given direction.
That's right. And I mean, sometimes they do. There's been maybe one experiment that's actually measured the photon. The rest of the time, they just do the energy loss. Yeah.
So you have this intermediate helium minus ion, right?
Yeah.
What's the lifetime? I mean, like, can you treat it like a, is it more like
no,
a...
No, I don't think you can really treat it like a metastable anything.
Okay.
It's, I think the lifetime is just...
So it's more like a resonance than a decaying state.
Yeah. Okay, so so far we actually have not looked at orientation effects yet. We've been looking at some other things, different models. One is the firstborn approximation. I'll give you the basic rundown of this. The projectile here is treated as a plane wave, which means that the interaction that occurs between the projectile and the target in either the initial state or the final state is not included. So the FBA model does not have that. Our next model, which we call 4DW without PCI, lots of acronyms, basically means that now we do include this interaction. So we put that projectile interaction with the target back in through something called a distorted wave. And the final model is that we are basically doing the same thing as the 4DW no PCI, but we have now added one additional interaction, which is the interaction between the scattered projectile and the ionized electron. That's called post-collision interaction, PCI. And so we, so far, have taken a look at those three models for excitation ionization. And we've done this in three dimensions. So I'll just show you a sort of preliminary plot of what we have. The FVA model gives us, these are for three different incoming projectile energies. In this case, the inactive, so to speak, electron in the helium plus is in the N equals 2 state. So it's the first excited state. And what you see is pretty much what you would expect. You get a what's called a binary lobe here, the big binary lobe, which comes from sort of classical forward scattering. You have a smaller recoil lobe, backward scattering, exactly what you expect, more likely to have the electron come out forward than it is to come out backwards. So that's pretty typical. If we now include the interaction of the projectile with the target, we have this other model. What you see is that this backward lobe gets enhanced. It's a little bit bigger than it was before. And if we go one step further and include the post-collision interaction between the two outgoing particles, in this particular case, we get a huge backward lobe. It gets bigger here as well. Not too much change at the largest projectile energy, but both of those effects seem to increase the backward scattering of our electron. So that is actually very preliminary, as of maybe just a week ago or something. It was right before I came out here, I guess. So far, conclusions are that the projectile interactions enhance the backward emission of the electron. The interaction between the outgoing particles also enhances it. Why? I have no idea. So, be happy to hear any ideas, but we're not quite sure yet on that. And we would like to look at the orientation effects, and we haven't done that yet either. So, okay, so I've had several students who have worked on this project when I was at Henderson State in Arkansas. Kayla Morrison worked on this with the frozen core approximation. She then went on to graduate school at the University of Arkansas in engineering, I believe. And I've sort of lost track of her. That was a couple years ago. So Tommy Esposito worked on the 3D excitation ionization. If you're wondering why I've scribbled a beard in on Tommy, the answer is that the first time he gave a talk at an undergraduate research presentation, he shaved. He normally has this beard, and so he shaved, and I was sitting there waiting for the talks to get started, and he walked in, and I hadn't seen him yet, and he's like waving at me, and I'm going, who is that guy, right? Finally, he gets closer, he goes, hey, Dr. Harrison. I go, oh, it's you, right? And he goes, yeah, I thought I should look good for my talk. So he shaved, and so I have to scribble in a beard because I don't really recognize him without a beard, so it was sort of funny. Evan Becker, I don't have a picture of Evan. He's worked on some of the four-body ionization stuff. And a side project I have is some computational neuroscience stuff, which I didn't talk about at all. And this is Annabelle. She's actually a 15-year-old high school student who's been working on a project with me. So with that, I will stop. So thank you.
Can you talk about if and how you add spin interactions in your...
We don't. Oh. So yes, I'm happy to talk about that. We don't.
And you don't have to worry about identical particle symmetrization?
Yeah, that's a good question. It depends on the energies. So let me... Here's a good picture. So yes, we should. The correct answer is we should. And we actually took a look at this a couple years ago and published a paper on it. It depends if these two guys are similar in energy. So if the projectile is very, very fast, then This guy is very, very fast as it scatters off, and so essentially they're sort of tagged in that sense, that you have a really fast one, because it's really unlikely that a fast projectile comes in and then suddenly goes out as the slow electron and one of these goes out very fast. That's unlikely, right? But if this guy comes in and these two go out at the same energy, for instance, you'll get a factor of two. If they're similar energies, then yeah, you do have to include that. You should also, in principle, include the fact that if this is an electron, it can come in and end up being sort of the bound electron here, and then these two could be the ones that get kicked out, but again, it's energy dependent, so if the energies are very asymmetric, then you don't have to worry about it, so.
So I'm sort of holding on by my fingernails with some old-fashioned two-body quantum, I don't know, Goldberger and Watson or some old book, as all I know. But it did seem that in your last pictures of the blobby stuff, the one on the top line really was the first time that you had anything that looked like, yeah, the 4DW, whatever that means. That looks like that effect would fill in the ring if it were occurring in the previous places where you were missing what the experiments had.
Yeah, I think it's deceiving based on these 3D plots. So
okay.
If you look at slices through these plots, then it's still
it still has the pinch.
It's still pinched off. It's just that I haven't entirely figured this out. I think this little yellow blob is the forward peak,
and everything else
is the backward. But it does look as if this has been sort of shifted from oriented maybe in this plane to oriented over here. And I don't know if that's really the case. I haven't looked at it in enough detail, but I did look at least one or two slices to know that it's still pinched off.
And you said that all of the positions and all of the momenta are known, but the experiment's usually done with beams, and then you don't know the position at all. You know the momentum, you know the angle.
They have position-sensitive detectors for the final
But that's really giving you the angle, not the position.
It's giving you, so if the projectile comes in and scatters over here and it hits the detector here versus hitting the detector up here, that's different to them. And they don't measure everything, they only measure enough to be able to work their way backwards from the momentum to know what everything's going. So I guess by position, I do mean angle, right? So, but they certainly can measure the momentum from their detectors and then they know where it hit to know the angle.
Right, and they know how much energy, so they know everything
that's
about
that
particular trajectory.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
On this plot right here, what are the colors telling me?
They're not really telling you much of anything other than to make it look 3D.
Okay.
So I think the... Yeah, they're not telling you anything.
Okay. Because, I mean, I since I'm working in few-body physics, too, right, although I'm, thank God, not in as many degrees of freedom as you, right, here's a claim I'll make. I don't think it's settled in few-body physics the best way to make these graphs. And this may be what you're doing, and I'm saying going against decades of history or whatever, but I don't know whether we have thought about the best way to visualize few body degrees of freedom in a way that is easy to interpret and share.
Right,
display.
I'm not sure. These 3D plots first came about, I think, in that picture I showed of the experiment and the theory from 2003 in the Nature article.
Yeah.
I think was maybe one of the first times that people started using
that.
And they're pretty and they're colorful. And actually, in terms of publishing, the journals and referees seem to like them because they
look nice. So this kind of plot's even only 12 years old.
Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Yeah,
but
so
typically, if you really want to convey the information, you got to do the two-dimensional slices so that you can get the quantitative information, because I haven't told you anything really. I mean, I've given you a little bit of a scale here, but I haven't told you anything about the magnitude of those. So if somebody wanted to try to compare their theory to my results in these 3D bubble pictures, there's no hope,
right,
other than qualitatively. So, yeah, I would agree with you. There's almost
hard.
Too much information, and how do you put all that into a plot. Yeah.
So back on the first half of your talk, is there any data on muon helium scattering? It would put you sort of in an intermediate mass range.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I've never heard anybody in my field talk about it, but that doesn't mean that there isn't.
I mean, I just did a quick Google search and I didn't see any like obvious thing immediately, but
yeah,
I figured asking you is probably better than doing a Google search.
I haven't heard of anything, but again, there might be.
More questions? In that case, let us thank Allison. And at this point, we are free to do whatever we want until there's wine. And then we must drink wine and we must eat cheese. It's a requirement, since they went to the trouble of providing it. So, thank you all.